We are delighted to have with us Sir Lynton Crosby, an Australian political strategist who has managed election campaigns. He's been described as the Wizard of Oz, as well as being called one of the most powerful and influential figures in Australia. Sir Lynton first became involved in politics with the Liberal Party of Australia, running successful campaigns in 1996, 98, 2001, 2004, federal elections, which made the Howard government, Australia federal government, the second longest serving. He has since run Conservative campaigns for the 2008 and 2012 London mayor elections, as well as the 2015 general election, all of which resulted in victories for the party. Outside of the UK and Australia, Sir Lynton has served as an advisor for parties in Canada, New Zealand, Sri Lanka, and other countries. Sir Lynton, we're delighted to have you today. And I wanted to kick things off with how life has been for you in the past few months during these unprecedented times.
Well, thanks, Sunil, and it's good to be here. Obviously, like everyone, one is having to change the way you go about doing business and interacting. I'm finding that I'm doing a lot more webinars like these and their business, which is a consultancy operating in eight countries, or based in eight countries, operating in many more, has both commercial and political clients. And through the use of technology, we've been able to maintain that aspect of engagement. But I think people are reassessing the way they go about communications and campaigns and how they engage with each other. One of the things that I know from a lot of research we've done over the years is that when you're facing times like these of uncertainty and change, people are looking from their political leaders for clarity of direction, sense that you're working to a plan. More recently, we've done research that shows that now people are looking for leaders who are innovative and inspirational. So I think as this thing's gone on, the longer it's gone on, the more people are confused about it and about the sense of when it's going to end. They're looking for leaders who can both give hope and sense of direction, inspiration, but also be innovative. So the way you go about business has to change. And we've found many ways within our own business that there's a need to change, and there are ways you can change.
It's interesting you've mentioned that. I've had a look and I heard you talk about how there's been obviously so much economic and social upheaval, and that leaders are craving inspiration and innovation rather than just solely focusing on managing the health crisis. I wanted to get a better understanding of, you know, the type of leader you think we'll be seeing post-COVID, whether it be in the UK, Australia, or just generally globally, the type of, if you like, the profile of the new age leader.
Well, I think the truth is that whatever the age, in terms of what era we're in, there are some requirements that are always going to be there. Napoleon once said that leaders were dealers in hope. So effective leaders have to give those who they're leading, whether it's in business or in politics, a sense that there's a better future, that they have a plan to achieve that better future. So dealing with a sense of hope, a focus on the future, an ability to communicate, an anchor of reassurance at a time of uncertainty. So that sense of having a plan in dealing with the current pandemic is an important requirement, but also someone who can offer new ways of dealing with things. I think there are a lot of different, it depends whether you're talking business or politics, but there are different requirements now. People are looking for, if you take political leadership, I think political leaders who can show that they've thought about the way the world's changing, and they're focusing on how to deal with that and how to respond to it. If you take, for example, the pandemic, it's been a massive fracture of the global economy and of the sort of what had become a quite accepted norm of increased globalization, the interconnectedness of countries through trade and economic opportunity. And we're seeing things like what I call economic sovereignty developing, where a country, take a country like Australia, where I happen to be right now, a country like Australia, very reliant on a small number of countries for a large share of its export markets, and also very reliant on countries and companies abroad for some key requirements like its own petroleum resources, you know, and so forth. So I think you're going to see increased economic sovereignty. Leaders will need to be able to show that they've thought about how exposed a country may be. And we're facing a pandemic today, but I think, you know, it could be cyber terrorism, attack on the financial centers of the world, using technology, who knows what. All of these things are possible. And what the pandemic has shown is disruption is possible. So one important requirement of any leader in business or in politics going forward is to understand the risks, the potential disruptions, and ensure they've got a plan to deal with those beforehand, not afterwards.
It's interesting, we're talking about leadership. I actually wanted to take you back to the 2015 UK election. You know, we all know you were able to successfully design a campaign that would mean David Cameron and the Conservative Party would get an increase of 24 seats and win an outright majority. When designing the campaign, what did you see as the most important areas that the party and Cameron sort of needed to work on?
Well, I think the first thing is, there are two ways to answer that. First is, you know, I thought that the Conservatives should have won an outright majority in 2010 and didn't. And so I was always of the view that there was work that was unfinished that meant they could win the majority in 2015, although that wasn't a popularly held view. But whenever you prepare for an election, indeed any sort of campaign, it could be a consumer campaign, it could be a campaign amongst shareholders, whatever it might be, I always prepare by trying to answer several what I call diagnostic questions. Seven questions generally that are the key. You know, what is the result you want? That's the first thing to understand. What is the result you want? And the result in the case of the parliamentary elections in Westminster are a majority of seats. In the current presidential election contest, it's electoral college voters in the right place. Neither of those elections, as it happens, require you to get a majority of the vote. You just got to get the right votes in the right places. So what is the result you want? Who will decide that result? What matters to them? How do you reach them? What do you say to them? How do you engage with them? And then how effective are you in engaging with them? And that's really, answer those seven questions, you've just written a campaign plan and a strategy. And so if you go to the 2015 election, well, we knew that there was less likely to be further gains, many further gains achievable in Labor seats. So we had to look at where else you could make gains. And that's when we identified a whole swathe of what was then more than 50 Liberal Democrat seats, a significant portion of which we thought the Conservatives would win. And the reason we thought the Conservatives could win them was because the campaign was built on sensible research. And we knew in the Liberal Democrat, a lot of people in the UK colloquially describe what a Liberal Democrat looks like. But actually what they're describing often is not a Liberal Democrat voter, they're describing a Liberal Democrat party member or MP. What we knew from the research we did in 2015 was that a majority of people in the Liberal Democrat seats, in fact, more people in Liberal Democrat seats than in any other type of seat, wanted a Conservative majority government. More people in Liberal Democrat seats wanted a Conservative majority government than people in Conservative seats wanted. And more people in Liberal Democrat seats wanted David Cameron as Prime Minister. And more people in Liberal Democrat held seats wanted David Cameron and George Osborne together to be in charge of the economy. But they didn't see the connection between those national ambitions, a Conservative government, David Cameron Prime Minister, George Osborne and David Cameron in charge of the economy, and how they voted locally, because they saw the contest locally as, oh, well, you know, Labour are not, it's either Labour or Conservative going to be in office, maybe in coalition. We don't want another coalition, they would say. They couldn't see how their vote could deliver the outcome that they wanted. And we had to show them, therefore, that their vote, even though they're in a seat currently held by the Liberal Democrats, that their vote could deliver that national outcome they wanted. And we also had to show them that they could get a Liberal, they could get a Conservative MP who would be every bit as good on the ground, because that was one of the sort of stories the Lib Dems used to tell about themselves. That is, they're good local campaigners, they're good, strong local advocates for the local community. So the campaign in 2015 was built around the sense that Conservative MPs could be effective local MPs who had their own, had plans for their local community and understood those local communities. And then on top of that, show people how they had the choice of David Cameron Prime Minister and Conservative majority government, or an uncertain outcome with Ed Miliband as Prime Minister propped up by the Scottish Nationalists. And so it was built on answering seven questions and doing proper research. And the same rule applies every time.
One of the things I saw on one of the patchwork foundations you've done, and mentioned in quite a few interviews, was the impact of emotion and reason being important factors when winning an election campaign. How do the two connect for you, and which do you believe was more important, especially with regards to the 2015 election?
That's a good question. Well, Ronald Reagan's pollster, Richard Wirtheland, late Professor Dr. Richard Wirtheland, used to say, you persuade through reason and you motivate through emotion. And more recently, Drew Weston, who's written a book called The Political Brain, says when in politics, when reason and emotion collide, emotion invariably wins. So if you go back to the 2015 election, the emotion is giving people a sense of hope for a better and brighter future. That sense of optimism that things can be better. The reason was having an economic plan, demonstrating that the Conservatives under David Cameron had a plan to secure a long-term future that was brighter and better. So the rational was the plan as a demonstration of an ability to deliver on the economy. The emotion was a sense of hope and a brighter future that you could achieve if you voted Conservative. And of course, there was an element of emotion too in the risk associated with Ed Miliband, who people didn't really know what he stood for. That gave rise to risk and uncertainty, being propped up by Scottish Nationalists. Ed Miliband was seen as weak by the voters, and they were therefore worried that his weakness would be used or manipulated by the Scottish Nationalists, because the voters did not think that Ed Miliband could win in his own right. So emotion is built around sense of optimism and a brighter future, or concerns about the personal consequences from risk associated with voting for the Labour Party and impact on the economy and risk to your job and all of that. And then the anchor for your emotional triggers is the rational exposition of your plan for a better future versus the policies that Labour may have. So a rational critique of their policies and the emotional consequences of those policies. It's often a problem in politics because particularly Conservative politicians often talk in quite rational tones about how they will grow the economy and create a million jobs. That really doesn't make an emotional connection with voters. Emotional connections are much more generally personal. So what does a million jobs mean? That means a million families or individuals with the opportunity of knowing they've got a more regular income. It means they've got the capacity to take responsibility for themselves. They can buy a home or rent, afford the rent. They can secure a better life. So you've got to make the link between the two, but you've got to communicate in ways that are personally relevant and trigger emotional connections for voters.
Taking it again on the 2015 election, shortly afterwards, you actually spoke about and almost predicted the new style of leadership that people would want. And maybe that also would explain where it was Ed Miliband that was chosen as opposed to his brother David, where you spoke about how we were almost moving away from the slick, smooth politicians. I heard you say, for example, how Blair towards the end of his spell was almost too smooth, and that because of cynicism and people working about out what spin meant, and the key going forward would be authenticity. And at the time you mentioned Boris Johnson in 2016 as someone who had that authenticity. With that in mind, do you still believe he has that authenticity in Boris, and do you still think it's very important today?
Well, I think authenticity is important, and you know, just the same old, in a sense, the way the voters think about it, actually what I think doesn't really matter. It's what the voters think and how the voters behave. And voters feel that the professional politician is someone who is slick and says what he or she thinks the voter wants to hear, but isn't necessarily personally committed to what they say, or doesn't have a set of values that guide them. Or that the voters are much more, part of the issue is voters are much more alert to the process these days. If you look at the way the media report about elections now, it's, oh, the Prime Minister's going to this seat because it's a marginal seat and it's one of those seats that will decide the outcome of the next election. Or the government's doing this in the budget because this is an appeal to the seats that were won by the Conservatives for the first time at the last election, and that's why they're introducing this policy or whatever. So people have a high degree of cynicism. The media tend to focus much more on the process of politics, and so when someone is more genuine or perceived to be more authentic, the voters we'll lap that up. It's not the only thing, though. I think now voters, partly because of this point that I just made about people understanding the process of politics more, they are often more thoughtful or deliberate in the way they use their vote. So they use their vote as a device to achieve a certain outcome. So if, for example, in the European elections, before the general election in 2019, when Brexit Party did extraordinarily well, many of the people who voted for the Brexit Party were not of themselves Brexit Party supporters. That is, they weren't members. They would probably never otherwise support the Brexit Party. They were using their vote for a Brexit Party candidate, particularly Nigel Farage, to as a device to send a message to the parliament and to other parties to stop mucking around. We voted for Brexit, get on with it. And if you look at what happened in the last presidential election in the US in 2016, people used their votes. You know, if you look at places like Wisconsin and Michigan, Pennsylvania, areas where there'd been strong, what you might call blue collar, working class Democrat voters, who switched their support to Donald Trump. They did so because In part, they felt the Democratic Party had left them. They did so because they wanted to use their device, their vote as a device, to say to people, hey, we're sick of being taken for granted. We're sick of being ignored. We want our concerns dealt with. They don't, you know, if you take some of the another group that supported Donald Trump, the evangelical movement in the US, I'm certain that most of those people don't, you know, wouldn't endorse the fact that he had multiple marriages or the way he speaks in certain on certain occasions or even the messages in some of his tweets. But they were using their vote as a device to say, hang on a minute, we want a particular outcome. The best chance for us to achieve that outcome is by voting for Donald Trump. So aside from a sense of authenticity and character, which I think is important as people have become more cynical about the motives of many in politics, the other thing is the deliberate use of people's vote to achieve a particular outcome. So people saying, I'm going to use my vote as a device to achieve a certain thing. And, you know, Donald Trump was a device for people to be heard in certain Rust Belt states, for example. The Brexit Party was a device where people used their vote to send a very clear message that they wanted Parliament to get on with it.
You've touched on the US, obviously with the US election only a couple months away. Mm. If you were a strategist for Joe Biden, you would were advising his campaign. What sort of things would you be telling him at this sort of stage of 2 months to go? And I also wanted to get your take on what you think a Biden administration would look like in comparison to a Trump second term.
Yes. Well, I think the first thing that Biden has to do is seek to achieve a broader coalition than they seem to be trying for right now. At present, if you look at Pew organization does a lot of polling. And the most recent that I saw showed that a majority of people who are voting for Joe Biden say they're doing so not out of endorsement for Joe Biden to be president, but to try to stop Donald Trump, which is hardly a positive motive. I think the first thing is I would be saying, hang on, we're very unlikely to be able to win enough votes in the right places by just not being Donald Trump or trying to make the election just about just a referendum on Donald Trump. You obviously need your base. You secure your base. So you take your base and you secure it, but that's generally not enough. You need the swing group, the soft voters in the middle. Sometimes those soft voters can be, as they were at the last presidential election, actually people from your own party who are just disconnected or discontented about something that, you know, you've done. So if I was Biden, the first thing I'd be doing is trying to broaden my support, not just appeal to my supporters. And I think the risk for him at present is they're focusing, you know, the usual suspects are supporting him. And he's talking about the usual things that you would expect a Democrat presidential candidate to talk about. But he doesn't really give a sense of hope for the future. It's I'm the best way to stop Donald Trump. I think very few people would be able to say what his plan is for the country. So I would be speaking a lot more about my plan, and I'd also be focusing on the economy, because the economy was President Trump's strong point. Before the coronavirus, he had a strong double-digit lead over the Democrats in relation to managing the economy, and of course the evidence was at the time the economy was going incredibly well. Now, he wanted this election to be a choice between Donald Trump looking after growing and protecting the economy, and Biden, you know, putting it all at risk, being part of a problem, you know, a career politician for 40 years, all of those things. Coronavirus came along and that upset the apple cart to a certain extent. now the narrative is more, we had a growing and wonderful economy before the Chinese communists gave us the coronavirus, and I'm best to stand up to them and I'll build the economy again. I did it once, I can do it again. So the contrast is Biden is saying he's not Donald Trump, but the other thing I would try to do is energize him and the campaign. There's a distinct, I think, lack of energy, and that feeds into the narrative about his age. And he really needs to, I remember with John Howard. John Howard, was in his mid to late 60s by the end of his prime ministership. But no one ever said, oh, he's too old, because he was always energy. There was a bit of discussion about his age, but not significant. And it wasn't a voting factor. He'd been there a long time. That was more a voting factor, because people get tired and look for something new sometimes. But he was someone who seemed as fit and energetic. He was, every election campaign, every morning, he was filmed on a brisk walk early in the morning with the media in tow or his security personnel in tow. So he created that sense of energy. Because they're trying to control Joe Biden, they're trying to control the message. And in most campaigns, control is a very important part of a campaign, because you've got to control your message to ensure that what people see and hear is what you want them to see and hear. But the problem is, and you've heard President Trump trigger this by talking about Sleepy Joe and hiding in his basement and all of that. I think the problem is people have a real question mark about his energy and whether he'll be able to last the distance and all of those things. So I'd also be trying to energize the campaign and energize him and have him positively advocating a strong agenda with a big economic focus in order to motivate people. And I'd be reaching out to those blue collar conservatives, small C conservatives, who had been traditional Democrat supporters, but who went away at the last election, because he's got to get them back.
You've worked extensively across the globe, and we've had a number of questions in, and I wanted to know what sort of the differences you found in particular working in Australia and in England. Just naturally cultural differences. Did that have much impact on the strategies you adopted in England in comparison to Australia?
Look, there's always differences. We've worked on campaigns in Iraq and in, Thailand and in Fiji and New Zealand and Sri Lanka and all sorts of places. And there'll always be cultural differences. They tend to affect the way you might communicate or the emphasis that you might use. But there's one fundamental truth. People are people the world over. They aspire for a better life, better opportunity for their children, a more secure future, shelter, a decent standard of living, all of those things. And so that doesn't change. It's how you communicate. So their basic needs, their essential needs and desires are the same, but how you communicate can be quite different, both for cultural reasons, but also there are other reasons as well. So, for example, Australia has compulsory voting. Everybody turns up to vote. Whether they like you, like your opponent, hate the lot of you, they're all there. So how you frame an election in that context is somewhat different to how you frame an election in a voluntary voting system. The good thing about the British political landscape is although it's a voluntary voting system, it hasn't gone to the extremes that one sees in America, where you have this very divisive, often based on social issue agenda that is used to motivate your base. Because whatever system you have, you need to secure and then motivate your base. So first thing you do is you you identify your base. You'll never win just by pitching to your base, but you identify them and then you motivate them to get out there and spread the message and to campaign on your behalf and all of those things. Because if your base is not motivated, you're not going to win. But you need to do more than that. You then have to persuade the soft voters, the swinging voters, the people in, you know, I don't think any voters really in the middle, but on this occasion, they may be undecided as to how they vote. You have to persuade them rather than just motivate them. Your base, there's little persuasion required because they're your base, but you have to motivate them. Your swing, that group in the middle, you have to persuade. And then your antis, you've got to try to neutralize your opponents. Now, in terms of contain their arguments and demotivate them to turn out if it's a voluntary voting system. What you see in America is it's all about trying to get your base out. That's the overriding objective. And so the way they do that is to try to polarize politics more and trigger emotion to get people out to vote, because it's a highly sort of motivated, you're trying to create a highly motivated environment. In Australia, you've got to do more. You've got to deal with everyone because they're all voting. And there's a group of people who you have to show, even though they may not like you or everything about you, that relative to your opponent, you're a better choice, because we also have preferential voting. So people get to put a number alongside every candidate. So it's a slightly more complex process. In the UK, it's about turning out your base and persuading the middle, the swing voters, and it's understanding those swing voters, identifying those swing voters, and then directly and personally communicating with them. But I don't see that there are some things, you know, there's things you can say in Australia you'd never get away with saying in the UK. There's some nuance around how things are dealt with. But at the end of the day, as I say, people are people and they have the same needs, wants and aspirations wherever they live in the world.
We actually had Malcolm Turnbull on here recently, the former Australian Prime Minister, and we discussed a number of different issues. He mentioned how he felt the Liberal Party was now being held hostage to the far right wing aspect of the party. How do you see today the current state of the Liberal Party in Australia, and just generally, what was it like working with Mr. Turnbull?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I think the party's in pretty good shape. You're only as good as your last election, though, and the government that you deliver. But overall, if you take, for example, how people judge Scott Morrison, the current Prime Minister, over the handling of coronavirus, I think they give him very good high points for that. They also give him points for believing in certain things, in aspiration, in reward for effort, in having a go. His father was a policeman. He's a down-to-earth person to whom people can relate. Malcolm Turnbull is an incredibly successful person, very articulate, very charismatic, got where he got by dint of his own hard work and effort. And both Malcolm Turnbull and Scott Morrison, very effective leaders in their own right, but also in their own way, because they're quite different people. I think the Liberal Party is doing well. I wouldn't choose one Liberal leader or one Liberal Party MP over another, because they're all God's children as far as I'm concerned. But I think Scott Morrison has very effectively presented himself as sort of the everyman, the every person, someone who's in touch with middle Australia and able to connect with them and understands their goals and aspirations. So I think the party's in pretty good shape. It's got a big challenge ahead of it in relation to the economic consequences of the pandemic. People have seen the government performed competently in managing the pandemic. The Liberal Party in Australia has a very strong lead over Labor as the party best able to manage the economy. And when it's all said and done, the country is a political economy. So the economy is absolutely fundamental to the fortunes and success of the country. And if you want good services, you've got to have a strong economy. There's no country that has a weak economy that delivers good services for its people because they're unsustainable. So the thing that the Liberal Party in Australia has consistently been able to hold is its economic mantle. And I think that's incredibly important.
Not far, obviously, from Australia, New Zealand. You know, we have the elections coming up shortly there. Do you think there's anything that National Party in New Zealand can do to close the gap in the polling?
I think it's going to be. It's quite a challenge, obviously. During the pandemic, people have been willing their leaders to succeed. They've given their leaders a lot of latitude because this is such an existential issue that they want their leaders to succeed. And so I think Jacinda Ardern is benefiting from that. I think she's benefiting from the fact that the national had been in office for quite a long time. And so, John Key had been very successful as Prime Minister. And so I think people were looking for a bit of a change. And so she certainly represents a change. And I think also she's demonstrated, she was seen to handle the attacks on the mosque early in her term in a very considered and measured way. And I think people reward her for that. So I think, although there are some very significant warning signs for the New Zealand economy, I think people are giving her at this stage the benefit of the doubt or the benefit of potentially another term. But it's still a way to go, and elections can turn very quickly. And expectations is quite an important thing in elections. I talked about factors influencing outcomes before, but one thing that I think is incredibly important is the context of the election, the context in which the election is fought. And if people think you're going to win or not win, that has real consequences in the way they view you. Funnily enough, if an opposition, take the last election in Australia when many people were surprised that the Liberals under Scott Morrison won, Labor had quite a radical agenda. It's a very significant change affecting older Australians and others in the community. But there were high expectations Labor were going to win. And that, in the end, if people think you're going to win, they look even more carefully at your policies and your proposals. If they don't think you're going to win, it doesn't really matter. Because, you can promise anything, but if you're not going to win, it's not going to happen. So you're less of a risk. So one of the questions that I think needs to be asked by New Zealanders is, if they think she's going to win easily, which a lot of New Zealanders clearly think, they need to look very carefully at her policies, because they are a real prospect. And she is certainly at the left wing end of the political spectrum. And I think that, in the end could mean the election is more close than people may think.
Well, it's a big impact on elections, and an area which we've discussed a number of political leaders on this platform is the media. I've heard you talk recently about how the media is turning into a mob mentality, where they seem to be amplifying messages and turning them into crises. In the UK, there's been a number of reports saying how the media, the lack of trust in the media, and we are at one of the lowest in Europe. I wanted to hear more of your thoughts on that, and do you envisage it changing much?
Well, you're right, I have said that, although it's sort of slightly been misreported. The point I was trying to make is there's a lot of groupthink that goes on in the media. And people talk a lot about the need for diversity. The most important type of diversity, I think, is cognitive diversity, the diversity of thought. If everybody thinks the same, then that really doesn't make for a vibrant society or for a challenging society, or it doesn't make for a fair and open media. And I think over time, the media have tended to, they've become somewhat identical in the way they, not all media, of course, there are variations, but more and more, particularly an organisation like the BBC, I think they're just so much all alike, all holding the same sorts of views, or very much holding the same sorts of views. And also, that's the first thing. The second, so sort of a narrowness and, you know, a particular perspective that they all seem, or so many now seem to have. There's much less independence of thought and difference of opinion. Second is that there is so much media with the addition of all the different social media platforms and 24-hour television news and all of these things, that the media are not, for the most part, investigators. They're content providers. They produce stuff. And that stuff has limited consequence and a very narrow shelf life. So they write an article, they publish a story, then they do another one, and then they do another one. When I first started in politics, we used to talk about the 24-hour news cycle. Now it's the second news cycle. It just turns over so very quickly. So I think they've become, on the one hand, more opinionated, but with a more narrow set of opinions. In another, they have they've become more commoditized, and the way they produce content is to let people know their opinions, which is easy to do, but not a lot of work. You know, they've got opinions on everything, but they investigate very little. And they don't, you know, they talk about diversity of appearance, but they don't do much about diversity of thought. I think I think that's another challenge in the media today. And the other is an understanding of the community in which they operate. So I think particularly so much around Westminster are people from within the M25 living in certain suburbs or part of London who have a particular perspective. And I remember, you know, when there was a high expectation of Labour winning again, if you believe the polls in 2015, and most of the media were saying, you know, David Cameron or the Tories are unlikely to win a majority. One television journalist said, I don't know, rang me and said, look, I don't know what's going on. I've been out in the country for 2 weeks outside of Westminster, and I just get a completely different feeling than what I'm getting from my colleagues and what's being reported back here in London. And Boris Johnson said the same thing to me during the Brexit campaign. He said, I don't know what's going on with the polls. I don't know what people are saying, because out here there's something happening. I can tell something's going on. And so, you know, I think a little bit they've lost some of this ability to understand the diversity of opinions across the United Kingdom, and they sort of tend to interact with only a certain type of people that reaffirms their own views and prejudices. Now, they're not bad people. I'm not having a go at any of them individually, but I just think that they've lost the perspective. You know, I remember very much in the 2015 campaign, there was a narrative going around the media for a while: this campaign's not exciting, and David Cameron's not displaying passion. And, you know, this, well, they wanted to somehow make things exciting by their measure. But not one voter in any focus group that we did during that time, and we did focus groups not to tell us what to believe or what our policies should be, but to how to more effectively communicate and understand what was going on. Not one voter in all the focus groups we did, and that was probably 50 focus groups, nor in any poll said David Cameron was lacking passion, right? But the media whipped themselves into this whole thing about lack of passion and David Cameron needs to show passion and all this sort of carry on. So I just think they've lost touch somewhat. They're blind to their own prejudices, and you've got to try to be objective and open. And the way they, I was going to talk about the American election, the way they spit out Donald Trump's name. Now, I don't relate to some of his policies, but there's, the media struggle to be investigators and reporters of news now, that they are much more participants, and they tend to follow each other. So that's my point about mob mentality. They all tend to assert the same point of view.
Yeah, sticking with the media, we've had a number of different ways of dealing with the media from the various political leaders we've had on this platform, particular tackling fake news. We had Malcolm Turnbull who mentioned about how, go back 10, 15 years, when there was a reported fake news or a news that wasn't, that he wanted to speak about, his ideology at that point would have been to ignore it. He believed if you spoke about it, you almost gave it legs. He then mentioned about how his approach now in the 21st century, and if there was future campaigns, it would be more to tackle the news outlets straight away. So, there was something about Medicare, for example, being sold in Australia, similar to NHS in England, being reported by media outlets. And his approach would now be to hit it on its head straight away. It's nonsense, if you like, rather than in the past where he believed, by doing that, you'd give it legs. I want your take on that and how you would, advising whether it be a political leader or a campaign, how they should deal with that sort of situation.
Well, the answer is it depends. It depends whether it's really having an impact or not. And it also depends on whether by raising the subject yourself, you are actually elevating it and making it more, more salient. So the answer is it depends. If you leave a vacuum, or if you your opponents make a claim and you don't challenge it and you leave a vacuum, that could lead people to say, hang on, why are you not talking about it? It all depends. One of the problems, this issue of the Medicare, what became known as Medicare scare, in Malcolm Turnbull's previous election, was that the Labor Party were running ads about it. We have television advertising in Australia. That is another big difference between Australia and the UK. And they were running this scare campaign, which basically said Liberals hate Medicare and they'll get rid of it. It'd be like if you had television ads in this country: Tories hate the NHS, they're going to get rid of it. It'd be that sort of thing. And the decision was made to largely ignore it and to focus on the Liberals' agenda. Now, that was, based on the research, was probably the right decision. But with all these things, you do have to look at the impact they're making and make a judgment at the time. You've got to make sure that you're getting enough weight behind your messages about yourself and your opponent for them to carry the day. If your opponent's message is starting to have resonance, then you have to deal with it. And there are different ways that you can do that. You might have counter-advertising. You might just have a debate about it. The risk is, in a rule of thumb for political campaigns is you try to establish differentiation between you and your opponent on the issues that are strong for you. So if you take Conservatives versus Labor, you try to differentiate with Labor on the economy because the Conservatives are seen as better economic managers. But then you try to minimize the difference between you and your opponents when it comes to issues where your opponents have a lead. So you try to differentiate so that on those things where you're strong, and you try to neutralize on those things where you're weak. In the course of a campaign, you know, a matter of a few weeks. It's very hard to change a voter's prejudice. That is, if they think that the Conservatives are not good with the NHS, if that was what they thought, then to try to change that perception established over years in a few weeks of an election campaign is highly unlikely to be successful. So what you try to do is you try to find ways to reassure people about the Conservatives and the NHS whilst establishing bigger differences on the economy, where you know Labor will spend more, tax more, and the Conservatives will enable you to keep more. They'll grow the economy so that tax revenues can fund the growth of tax revenues can fund their vital services, but you won't be hit personally.
I mean, again, mentioning media and a politician who is regularly brought up on our platform and is Priti Patel. She tends to divide quite a lot of opinion. Naturally, being a Conservative forum, we tend to have more support for her. You were one of the actual signatories for the 92 people who backed Priti Patel during the smear campaign. Do you think the portrayal the media have of her is unfair? And what was it like working with her?
Well, look, you know where you stand with Priti. And, you know, that's a good thing, because so often people, you know, particularly British people, they use words like interesting and so forth and never actually say what they mean. So I think people respect her because she's feisty. She knows what she believes in. They may not agree with everything that she believes, but at least they know where they stand. And I think that's her great strength and her feistiness and her preparedness to stand up for what she believes in are qualities that people respond well to. And so just because people criticize you doesn't mean you're wrong. Just because they praise you doesn't mean you're right. You've got to know yourself what you believe. You've got to weigh up the decisions you've got to take and look at the evidence. And then based on what you believe and what the evidence tells you, then you take action that you think is fit. But you see fit. In terms of the letter you mentioned or the support that people gave her, I think that people are tired of people who mince their words or try to, you know, not upset anybody. It's part of the problem in the world today. You can't say anything, because if you do, then because somebody disagrees with you, you're not entitled to say it. Well, that's not the basis on which people should be able to communicate. You don't have to agree with someone if you don't agree with someone, it doesn't mean you should deny them the right to express their view.
It's interesting you mentioned that. We've had a number of politicians mention about council culture, which is essentially similar to what you're saying, in a sense, you think differently to someone, then you shouldn't be allowed to voice that opinion. Again, with Priti Patel, we saw the article in The Guardian. I'm not sure if you're aware of the Cal.
I'm not a regular reader of The Guardian.
It was going to lead on to my question. Do you think there is a left-wing bias in the media at the moment? It's something that, again, a few people have mentioned on our platform, a couple of Tory MPs. Do you think that there is?
I don't think there's a necessarily a partisan divide in the way that people say, well, I'm Labour and I'm not going to support the Tories. I think there's a values difference. So many in the media have a set of values that may not be aligned with the values that many Conservatives hold, or more broadly, the British community. So I'm not, as I say, there's plenty of fine people and very competent writers and all of that in the media, but there's no doubt, particularly with the BBC and Channel 4 and so forth, there is a particular socially progressive, relatively narrow issue perspectives that they constantly focus on. They talk a lot about diversity, but they don't display it themselves very often. I certainly think that there's a difference of opinion on a lot of issues. You know, there seems to be, you know, the media imply that it's wrong to be patriotic if you're British, that Britain should be wringing its hands over its past. They don't always seem to reflect, and that's not the view of the majority of British people, right? So I think what's happened over time is there's been a narrowing of the issue agenda on the subjects that many in the media talk about. That is one of the reasons that they're less trusted and less engaged with today, because they reflect a lack of understanding of the broader perspective of the British people themselves.
Again, it's something we've often agreed on, what you're sort of saying, especially, you know, people like Priti Patel, who sort of display, you know, we talk about diversity in media, diversity in the workforce, wherever. I think, like you earlier mentioned, diversity of thought is probably the key, and someone like Priti Patel clearly has that in terms of, you know, a different from what you'd expect, probably from an ethnic minority, and it's quite refreshing. We always get a lot of compliments on her on this platform. We're seeing a huge change in politics. It's been talked about a lot on here, with, you know, people are calling it the age of polarization, with, you know, far left and far right rising, and people seemingly thinking the voice of reason is often being ignored. Do you see that changing much, and have you experienced that in recent campaigns? Sure,
I think it is changing. I think division is becoming greater. It's partly this point we're discussing, lack of tolerance of someone else's viewpoint, or even understanding of the fact that someone's got an alternative viewpoint. I think also social media is a voice for that. The way social media earns its money is by clicks, and therefore, you know, they want to polarize and divide so that they motivate people to click, to access stories and content so that they can be paid more for it. I think also there is a sense of sort of, because there's so much media and people got so many alternatives, to try to get heard or to try to make an impact, you have to be more extreme or a bit more hysterical. And so it's much less about considered debate, and it's much more about, you know, crisis, scandal. I spoke at a conference a year or two ago, and I, as part of the process, did a research analysis of the BBC's online website, online news stories on its website. And in a matter of a few months, there were literally dozens of stories that talked about crisis. There was the education crisis, the NHS crisis, the this crisis. There was even a Kentucky Fried Chicken crisis, because around that time, Kentucky Fried Chicken had changed the distributor of its chicken to its stores, and the new distributor was not coping well enough. And so some stores did not get their supplies of Kentucky Fried Chicken. Well, it's many things, but I don't think it's a crisis. And unfortunately, phrases like crisis, scandal, attempts at gotcha, you know, when there's an interview, they're not trying to extract information that leads the viewer themselves to draw their own conclusion. They're wanting to create a moment, a vignette, when there'll be something that is controversial that can then be cut and put on the news services and put on websites, and viewing increased that way. So I think that's part of the problem. I saw a poll again a year or so ago that said that only 16% of British people thought that social media was a force for good. And I think that's a big change from when, you know, Facebook and these other platforms came out. People thought this was going to be a new way to engage and connect and be positive. Instead, it's become a vehicle, or the social media more generally, technology platforms have become vehicles for bullying and harassment and division and not bringing people together, but much more driving them apart. And that's part of the problem. Of course, in politics, in an election, you're trying to frame a choice, because people have to make that choice when they put, you know, when they complete a ballot paper. They have to choose one candidate over another. But you've got to do so in a way that doesn't so undermine society as a whole.
It leads on quite well to a question on democracy we have here. For the 14th year, it's been reported by Freedom House that democracy has been on the decline. They found that political freedoms and civil liberties across the world are backsliding more often than they're improving. How do you see the general state of democracy globally?
Look, I think there's a difference between, I think it's, we've got more democracies today than historically there have ever been, but the practice of democracy is changing. There's no doubt about that. And times of uncertainty and change, as we're witnessing now, can lead to an erosion in democracy. I think that, so, you know, one would have to be concerned. In a way, it's more about the West, I think, than less developed countries that are still have a sense of optimism and confidence in the direction of their countries than perhaps we're seeing in the West, as people feel that things aren't what they used to be, systems don't seem to be working anymore. But, you know, the relative to the alternatives, democracy remains such an important and valuable thing, but it's fragile. And it, unless people make the case for it and stand up against those who would undermine it and aren't afraid to articulate its importance and power, then decline occurs. And it occurs at home, but also occurs abroad. So, you know, the West, you know, combination of factors, but the West doesn't always stand up for what it believes in anymore. It turns a blind eye to incursions into the Ukraine. It attacks some things, but then continues to do business with the very countries it attacks. So I think, you know, we've got some real issues to address, but there's no doubt in my mind that the democratic system ultimately is the best and most empowering for most people.
We've had a question come in from Harry and Maidenhead. It's regarding the mayor election next year in London. Mm-hmm. You're obviously involved in two successful campaigns with Boris Johnson, have experience in, you know, winning an election for the Conservatives. What tips would you be giving, or strategy would you be using for Sean Bailey next year with regards to the London mayoral election?
Well, first thing is to answer those seven questions I talked about before. What's the outcome you want? Who will decide it? What matters to them? How do you reach them? And so forth. The mayoral election, one of the things we found in the first election when Boris Johnson was mayoral candidate was that people didn't think mayor mattered to them. Most people in London didn't vote in the mayoral election. And the further you got away from the centre of London, the fewer people who voted for mayor. So the key thing is to help people understand why the mayoral contest is important for them. And you have to do that by the issues you focus on and help them understand that you're a champion for the issues that matter to them, and that if they want those issues dealt with and they've got concerns about issues that have been overlooked, then they've got to turn out and vote, because it's the act of voting that can bring about change that you need. So you've got to, London is a place you've got to break it up into small units. You've got to target the issues that are relevant to people within those units. This is a process explanation I'm giving now. And then really ensure that you reach those people. There are a lot of Conservatives in London, in Greater London. They don't always vote. You've got to get them out to vote. So you've got to lock in your base and then you start to identify the swing. I mean, there are issues such as knife crime and other things that have been overwhelmingly, if not ignored, they've sort of certainly significantly deteriorated under this mayor. And he talks a good game on occasion, but delivery is very rare. He's a man who said he was going to cut transport charges, and they've gone up regularly. He's sought to cut the police. He's been, I think, quite divisive as a mayor. But you've got to show, if you're the mayoral candidate, you've got to show that you want the job. And one thing about Boris is, you know, he worked relentlessly as the candidate. He was out every day using his ability to communicate to build that profile and then to talk to people about the issues that matter to them.
Well, finally, a final question. Being Conservative Friends of Commonwealth, it's a question we regularly ask. With the UK no longer being in the EU, how do you see the relationship between the UK and other Commonwealth countries such as Australia developing?
Well, I think there's huge opportunity, and I can understand because of some historical circumstances, there's sometimes a reluctance on the part of the British to fully engage, or there's a nervousness because of Britain's colonial past or whatever you might describe it as. But the thing that I've found, not just as an Australian, although it's certainly true in the case of Australia, that most of the countries and most of the people in most of the countries that are Commonwealth countries have a very strong affinity with Britain. They have shared heritage, sometimes language, not always language, but systems and history, all of those things. And they want to do more. So there's a huge opportunity. I think it's a really untapped opportunity. And I'm a member of the Commonwealth Enterprise and Investment Council, chaired by Lord Marland, and that seeks to bring businesses from across the Commonwealth together to enhance growth and trade and so forth, economic opportunity. And it gets great support, it gets growing support, and there's a lot of enthusiasm in the African and the Asian countries that are part of the Commonwealth. And I think Britain should be much more unashamed about its past and in engaging with these countries to develop and secure more more economic growth and a more prosperous future for both Britain and the countries.
Well, that concludes our webinar today. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here, Sir Linton. I know you don't do too many media and generally interviews, so it's been we're honoured that you took the time and gave us this fantastic conversation. Hopefully we can see you again sometime soon.
And hopefully we'll get back to London soon.
Yeah. Well, hopefully once the restrictions ease, and it'd be great to actually do this one day in person. And I'm sure as restrictions ease and things get better, Conservative Friends of Commonwealth will be back to holding physical events. We have an event forthcoming to our audience during the Conservative Party Conference Week. So have a look at our social media channels and emails. You'll get a notification regarding that. But thank you for your time, Sir Linton.
Thank you, Sam.
Hopefully we'll see you again.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me. Goodbye.
Cheers. Bye.